I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, reflections and perspectives on the shooting at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis. Five people were killed yesterday afternoon by a gunman who allegedly harbored a grudge against the paper for its coverage of his harassment of a high school classmate. I'm joined today by Indira Lakshmanan, a columnist for the Boston Globe and the chair of the Ethics in Journalism Committee at the Poynter Institute. She studies trust in the media. Dominique Maria Bonesi of the WIPR News team will have the latest on the investigation. I'll ask security expert Keith Williams how people can prepare for an active shooter situation. Dr. Paul Nestat is a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He studies guns and mental illness. Jamie Costello is a journalist at WMAR Television. Their newsroom was attacked 4 years ago. And Joel Simon, he's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. They join me to talk about the tragedy in Annapolis. Good afternoon. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, several perspectives on the murders at the Capital Gazette newspaper. As I'm sure you've heard, a 38-year-old man from Laurel killed five people and injured two others at the offices of the Gazette on Bestgate Road in Annapolis yesterday afternoon. A little later in the program, WIPR's Dominique Maria Bonesi has the latest in the investigation into that shooting. I'll also speak with a security expert, a psychiatrist who studies mental illness and firearms, a journalist whose newsroom was also attacked 4 years ago, and the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We'll take your emails and tweets if you have questions and comments. We will not be able to take your phone calls today. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. My first guest is Indira Lakshman. She is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and she holds the Newmark Chair in Journalism Ethics at the Poynter Institute. That's an organization that provides training and resources for journalists around the world. She joins us from the Tampa-St. Petersburg area in Florida. Indira, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this event is less than 24 hours old, but literally within minutes of this hitting the news of this hitting the internet and television yesterday, people were drawing a line and asserting a lineage between the rhetoric of Donald Trump, both on the campaign and as president, about journalists and about the media, finding lineage between those remarks and the event that happened yesterday. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, look, as we have found out since, this was a man, the alleged shooter, who had a specific vendetta against this newspaper because of truthful coverage, let's point out. He was mad about a column they wrote, and he tried to sue them for defamation and failed. But they wrote about his guilty plea for harassing a former classmate of his online over the course of years, it seems. So he had a specific vendetta against this paper, but it certainly does not help in any way that there is such poisonous rhetoric about the press out there led by the occupant of the Oval Office. I mean, in a democracy, as we know, a healthy press is vital to a healthy democracy. Without one, you don't have the other. And it's inexcusable that the president and his allies should constantly bombard people with this idea, this falsehood, that the press is somehow the enemy of the people. That's not true at all. In fact, journalists are members of our communities who live in every one of our communities and cover our school board meetings and our zoning commissions and police reports and everything. I've been a local journalist. You're a local journalist. And, you know, we're doing the work of connecting communities to information and news. So it's certainly poisonous to have this kind of rhetoric. In this particular case, it doesn't seem as if the man was motivated by that. But, of course, we have to find out what the investigation shows.
Right. Of course, there's no evidence at this juncture as to whether or not this shooter is a supporter of Donald Trump or not, whether he's been influenced by any of anybody's rhetoric. Your point about the importance of local journalists and community media outlets like the Capital Gazette or like our NPR affiliate here in Baltimore. Our friend Alec McGillis, who writes for ProPublica, won a Pulitzer Prize with a team from the Washington Post years ago, has made the observation that because there are fewer local journalists, because even newspapers like the Baltimore Sun have drastically cut down the number of people in their newsroom from years past. Because of that, there are fewer people who know journalists. There are fewer people who whose kids play on the Little League team with kids of journalists, or attend a synagogue or a mosque together. They know fewer people in the journalism business, and that perhaps is contributing to some degree to the distrust in media. What do you think about that? Are these personal connections vital to people restoring their trust in the media?
Look, I mean, both of those things are true. On the one hand, it's absolutely true that we are watching really the death of local news, and it's a crisis that needs to be arrested. The Poynter Institute is one of the institutions that is working on trying to revive local news. There are a number of foundations and programs out there, nonprofit news sites, like you mentioned, ProPublica. It's just one of many nonprofit news sites that are trying to address the sort of collapse in the revenue model and how digital journalism has disrupted the one-time revenue model based on classified advertising and advertising and subscriptions, which has all changed. That's all true, that the lack of local news people, is a crisis for our country. As for whether the problem is that we're not meeting those journalists, I mean, I think that's one issue, but there's no question that this distrust in the media is something that has been building over decades. If you look at the longitudinal data from Gallup, that goes back to the 1970s of people's trust in the media, it has been falling drastically since the 1980s and the deregulation of, the FCC, the end of the Fairness Doctrine, which led to the rise in right-wing talk radio, allowed for cable news and Fox and other institutions that have characterized the mainstream media as somehow false. So there's been distrust going on for decades. It does predate Donald Trump. As an addendum to one thing you said about us not knowing whether this particular shooter was a supporter of Donald Trump, I have read reporting stating that in one of his social media threats against the paper, which again was about this column that he didn't like, which he thought was defamatory, even though it was simply reporting on his own guilty plea in a courtroom. In one of his threatening posts, apparently in 2015, he said to the paper that if it continued to criticize Donald Trump's unfitness for office when he was running for president, that it would, quote, not end well, or it would end badly. So there is that. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't familiar with that. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Of course, what's the antidote to distrust in the media? I mean, a lot of people point to the fact that if the media does its job and gets the story right and writes truthfully and factually accurately, that in and of itself is not necessarily enough. You know, veracity and verisimilitude is not enough to counter those who come to the table assuming that there is some sort of bias or that there's some sort of, innate defect in journalism today.
You know, you're right. It's a crisis. It's something that many people, including myself, are working on, trying to figure out what are the ways to restore and rebuild trust in journalism. I think that one of the ways is being incredibly transparent about what we do, why we do it, and how we do it. And there's a lot of good work going on in newsrooms across the country where people are doing things like launching Facebook Live with the audience, with the readership, doing sort of ask me anything, responding to all of the questions that people might have. I think one problem is that we take for granted as journalists that the things we do are obvious, that we talk to people, that we seek truth, report it independently, report it fully. We try to minimize harm as we do all of these things. But I think that average Americans, very intelligent people who aren't in journalism, simply don't understand what we do. They don't understand what anonymous sources are, for example. Everywhere I go, people will say to me, how can we trust you in the media when you're using people who you don't even know who they are? And I have to explain, no, I know exactly who they are. I've vetted their information. My editors know who they are. We simply can't identify them because their job is at risk or their life is in danger. But we should be much more transparent in our stories about explaining why someone is not named. That's just one example. We need to be better about explaining the difference between news and opinion. so people can understand that a pundit, a talking head on cable TV is not the same as a reporter. That's just one example.
Let's talk a little bit, and then I know we have to let you go, about social media and the fact that so many of us are on social media. We do make comments that are outside our normal broadcasts or publications. Is that playing into people's distrust in that they're reading stories that we're writing, they're hearing broadcasts that we're producing, but they're also then hearing on Twitter or on Facebook or Instagram personal opinions or takes on stories that indicate a bias one way or the other?
You know, I think that's an excellent question, and it's one that journalism is grappling with, and all the newsrooms that I talk to are grappling with what are their rules for social media behavior and what journalists should be able to say and not say. My guidance is always think before you tweet. And essentially, if you would not say that, if you would not put your byline on top of something that you're saying on social media, if you would not say it on TV, if you would not say it in a radio interview, then please do not tweet it. You know, there is, you know, social media is just, for us journalists, it's another form of journalism. It's another way of telling a story. And it can be really useful and helpful, but putting out your opinion if you are a news journalist is not helpful, in the same way that, you know, we wouldn't have journalists marching in political rallies or having bumper stickers on their cars supporting certain candidates. It is not helpful to put out what can be perceived as partisan opinion on your social media feed. But I think that's only one of many factors that's playing into why people trust the media. And I do think that the president and all of his aides and allies have a responsibility to take, you know, a different tone towards the press and to be talking about how we need to defend press freedom and how the press is vital to a healthy democracy. That's the message that they need to be putting out there, not the message of calling the press the enemy of the people. And I'm really disappointed that in the president's tweet yesterday after this Capitol Gazette shooting, although he did say, you know, hopes and prayers for the victims and their families, and then he praised first responders, he refused to talk to the press later when the White House press corps was asking him, will you make a statement? What is your statement? He just walked past them, and it was Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau.
Oh, we may have lost Indira there. Yeah, I think Indira's final point was that Justin Trudeau from Canada, who's been in the news for all sorts of other reasons, was the one who made the statement about the importance of journalism. We have an email from Sally who says, unless I missed it, the silence from the White House has in fact been deafening. So I'm sorry we lost Indira Lakshman, but we will have her on again to continue this conversation. We're going to take a quick break. Indira Lakshman, by the way, a columnist for the Boston Globe, and she's the chair of journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute. She's also a frequent guest host on many NPR programs, which makes her a very familiar voice to many of our listeners. By the way, there is a GoFundMe drive that has been set up to help the people at the Capital Gazette, and you may also want to consider subscribing to the Capital Gazette. As I mentioned, a quick break, then we're going to have an update on the latest in the investigation into the murders at the Capital Gazette yesterday. Dominique Maria Bonesi joins me when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, Maryland Comptroller Peter Franchot will be my guest for the hour. If you're just joining us today, we are discussing yesterday's deadly shooting at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis. Joining me now, my colleague here at WYPR, part of our news team, Dominique Maria Bonesi. She and Joel McCord, our news director, were covering this story yesterday. Dominique, what's the latest on the investigation?
Hi, Tom. So today they had a pre-trial hearing. It was the bail hearing. He is the suspect accused is Jared Ramos, 38, of Laurel, Maryland. He is being charged with five counts of first-degree murder, each count for one of the employees of the – each count for one employee of the Capital Gazette. State's Attorney Wes Adams is the prosecutor in this case. He obviously asked for no bail for Ramos. He said that the reason for this was his strategy, his tactical strategy, where Ramos actually went to the back door, barricaded the back door, then went around to the front of the building, shot through the glass of the Capitol Gazette, and began shooting into the Gazette offices and shooting those who were trying to exit through that barricaded back door. So he's saying that that it's in itself was a danger to society and malicious in the intent. Public defender William Davis for Anne Arundel County is representing Ramos. He is asking for a gag order. So for anyone in the trial, even a state's attorney, Wes Adams, he is asking for a gag order on the press. Therefore, no one in the trial would be able to talk to that. The judge denied that motion, saying that if Mr. Davis had something in writing, then maybe he would consider it. But as of right now, he's not considering that.
So clearly, the prosecutors are alleging a lot of premeditation in this. I wonder, yesterday there were reports that Mr. Ramos had no ID on him, no wallet, no driver's license, that kind of thing, and that he'd even done something to his fingertips to avoid detection in terms of his identification. Have you heard anything more about that? Did he take any measures to stay unknown to the police for as long as possible?
So the prosecutor, Adams, he would not address that directly about anything that Mr. Ramos might have done to his fingertips. However, in the statement of probable cause, it says there is surveillance within the business. The surveillance was reviewed positively, identifying Mr. Ramos and the events that occurred within the business. So the cameras and facial recognition software helped identify him, although he did not have any previous record of any criminal activity. There is the court case in which he sued the Capitol Gazette back in 2011 for a defamation lawsuit, but nothing criminal.
Any idea when a trial might take place?
Another trial. For right now, we're not sure if this would be a preliminary hearing or this would be a jury trial. Within the next 30 days, we should be hearing something.
Dominique Maria Bonesi from the WIPR News team. Thanks, Dominique. Appreciate it. And we look forward to more reporting on this.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm going to turn now to Dr. Keith Williams. He's the Vice President of Support Services at Admiral Security. That's a company that provides security for buildings like the one in which the Capitol Gazette offices are located. Dr. Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
So there are a lot of folks who are listening in offices that look very much like the offices that house the Capitol Gazette. What do you tell your clients when you provide security to locations like this about what they might be able to do to prevent this situation? Is there any way to defend against it? And then if heaven forbid, it happens, what should they do in the middle of it?
Well, Tom, I think the same thing that, you know, there's been a lot of studies out there. The Department of Homeland Security has done some things. And one thing I want to point out is a lot of these events, half of them occur in business settings, and two-thirds are occurring between 7 and 3. So they do affect all of us as we go about our normal business. And what we try to have people do is have situational awareness. We preach the plan, prepare, act. Have a plan. Know what you're going to do. Think about these things beforehand. I don't want people to live in a state of paranoia, but a state of preparedness. Preparation goes to the ability to know where your emergency exits are, not just one, but maybe two. What's your alternative? And if you have to act, as in flee or hide or fight and take survival actions, the goal is to survive.
And you talk about the notion of survival inoculation. So is that what goes into survival inoculation, at least having some notion of where you might run, where you might hide? In this situation, as Dominique Maria Bonessi just reported, prosecutors are saying that this shooter barricaded a back door, came in the front door, and then as people were trying to flee through the back door, gunned them down. What would you suggest that people think about in that kind of scenario?
These are purposeful acts. The things we're saying and the things we're seeing with these active shooters, active assailants, is they're purposeful. Those folks have a plan. We need to have a what if in our own workday world, in our own survival mechanism, to say, what happens if I run to the only emergency exit that I know and it's blocked? Where would I go? Where would I hide? What would I do? Is there something that I can use to hide behind or hide in a file room or in a place of refuge? Is there something that I would have to do that, God forbid, the last, ditch effort is I have to fight? Now I have to undertake some kind of action against that person who's coming at me. And what should I do? And it really is walking kind of around in a what-if state of mind.
When you have these clients, and you're advising them about office buildings, that sort of thing, businesses, do you ever suggest that they change the architecture or that they make some physical changes to their environment with this sort of potential tragedy in mind?
Absolutely. We do active assailant presentations on a regular basis. We do these physical security reviews with building management and with tenants themselves to see just where the threats may pose, where we would have to make some changes or make some suggested changes of this. How do you change your access control? Where would you put certain file rooms or places of refuge? And when we do the presentations for the clients or tenants, we ask them, do you know where the emergency exit is? Yes. Well, how many steps does it take you to get there? And once you get in there and you're in that stairwell, do you know where it goes? Do you know where it takes you when you get to the bottom of the building and you have to exit out of the building? And it challenges people to think this way, and we challenge our clients and tenants to think this way as well.
Do you, when you, in some instances, obviously, you place physical people, you place security guards in front of buildings or inside buildings. Is that generally considered to be a very good deterrent?
I think in most instances, the solid access controls along with a security officer, whether they're armed or unarmed, is a significant deterrent. Their first responsibility is to observe and report, so they can have that situational awareness. We train them to be situationally aware. We send out alerts as with yesterday, we're sending out alerts to make people aware of what's going on in all of our venues that we have so that the officers are knowledgeable about that as well. But having a uniformed person, having somebody of authority there along with a solid access control plan, I think plays a big role in providing safety.
Anne Arundel County Police are credited with showing up to the scene very quickly, within 60 or perhaps at the most 90 seconds. They did an active shooter drill just recently. Do you ever run through active shooter drills or active assailant drills with your clients, so that for the people who are actually in the building that doesn't involve police or law enforcement in any way?
Absolutely. We do a kind of a three-tiered approach. One is an active assailant, just a presentation, kind of an awareness presentation that we do an hour or two at a time for whoever wants to do it. We'll also do tabletop, where it's a safe environment, but we put some pressure on people to say, here's the situation, what would you do? What's your responsibility? Where would you go? What would you do? And we even partner with local law enforcement to do live drills where we practice the run, hide, fight and put people in role-playing situations. And most of the law enforcement in this area are professionals at doing that. Anne Arundel County is very, very good at this. They know what to do. The Metropolitan Police Department does this on a regular basis with whomever, and it gives you a real-world example of just how you would act in one of these situations.
Dr. Keith Williams is the Vice President of Support Services at Admiral Security. Dr. Williams, I appreciate your time and your perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to turn now to Dr. Paul Nestat. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. His research focuses on firearms, particularly in regard to suicide. Dr. Nestat, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
By the way, congratulations are in order. I understand that today is the first day of your appointment as an assistant professor at Hopkins, so congratulations.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
There is an assumption in these situations that have become all too familiar to us that the shooters in these scenarios are mentally ill, that's at the root cause of their violent behavior. What's your reaction to that?
We certainly see that tendency after every one of these events, and they're just more and more frequent. We hear people talking about mental illness, assuming that a gunman has mental illness. Usually these come from people that maybe trying to focus on mental illness as opposed to other things like access to guns or as Indira is pointing out, animosity towards journalists. But this is sort of a dilemma for those of us who treat and work in mental health, because on the one hand, you know, psychiatrists need to be advocates for our patients, and we fight for funding and resources for treatment, which are related to awareness. But on the other hand, anyone familiar with the data knows that focusing on mental illness is a bit of a red herring. Less than 5% of gun homicides are committed by someone with a mental illness. And these are mostly folks who have a comorbid substance dependence issue, confounding it. Among mass shooters specifically, only about 15% have had any previous contact with mental health care. The only thing that really all of them have in common, all mass shooters are armed. And so guns are a worthwhile thing to talk about. On the other hand, you know, people with mental illness are 2.5 times more likely to be the victims of violent crimes, because this is a sometimes stigmatized and sometimes marginalized population. The last thing we want to be doing is further stigmatize mental illness.
When you mentioned that, you know, there's a small percentage of mass shooters that have had, interaction with mental health professionals, does that discount the fact that even though they may not have sought treatment, they may have some very serious psychological and psychiatric problems?
Yeah, that's a good point. And there are people that might not have sought treatment. But the fact is that if we're trying to address these issues by, you know, sort of focusing on the mentally ill, we'll only be able to see those that do seek treatment. We're not going to be knocking on doors and doing spot checks or anything like that. So the fact that the sorts of, when there are any sort of mental illness phenomenon going on in a shooter,
all right. Evidently, we have lost Dr. Nestat. I want to give you a little update on this fingerprint issue while we try to get Dr. Nestat back on the line. Joel McCord, the news director here at WIPR, reports that Anne Arundel Acting County Police Chief Altamirie says that there was something of a lag in getting the fingerprint information from the alleged shooter, and perhaps somebody misinterpreted that. But there is no truth to the claim that the shooter altered his fingerprints in some way to avoid detection or avoid identification from the Anne Arundel County Police. So we can put that rumor to rest. And like so many things that happen in these stories, things will develop. We will learn much, much more than we have. This event did occur less than 24 hours ago. So we know an awful lot, given the fact that the time frame has been so brief, but we don't know everything for sure. So I guess we have Dr. Nestat back, and our apologies for some technical problems.
Okay.
There are a lot of people who would say, and I hate to be blunt and use non-medical language, but you have to be crazy if you're going to shoot people. Is there a way of being a mass shooter and not have any mental illness at all? How does that work? If that's not mentally ill, then what is?
That's a good point. I guess it depends on how you define mental illness. But the fact is that people shoot other people for all sorts of really terrible reasons, having nothing to do with mental illness. In this shooter's case, maybe he felt that he was wronged by an article that reported unfavorably on him. As Indira reported, maybe he was inspired by some of the rhetoric, sort of anti-journalist rhetoric. There was a Milo Yiannopoulos had texted a reporter from the New York Observer saying that he wanted vigilante squads to gun down journalists. So who knows what other things might have played into this, but there's no evidence yet that there was any mental illness in this case, or as I said before, in most cases of mass shooting.
So then how do you define mental illness then? How is it defined outside of a violent behavior? Obviously, it's defined outside of violent behavior, but give us a thumbnail sketch of what violent of what mental illness actually is.
Well, an important thing to point out is that word illness, right? So in the DSM, which is sort of the manual of psychiatry, for anything to be a mental disorder, there has to be a disorder. They have to, you know, have some trouble in the way that they think, some functional impairment that makes it hard to get along. There are things that are more temperamental that can affect those sorts of things. People can be antisocial, or people can have trouble managing their emotions, but that's more of a dimension, more of a spectrum, where everybody to some degree is more or less neurotic or more or less introverted. There's a fundamental difference with a categorical illness, like something like schizophrenia, where there's maybe even, you could think of it as a broken part that affects multiple domains of thinking, disorganization, oftentimes there's delusions, fixed false idiosyncratic beliefs, or even hallucinations, sort of perceptions of no stimulus. So those things are more true mental illnesses.
There's some reporting that the former publisher of the Capital Gazette, Mr. Marquardt, who is now retired and living in a retirement community in Florida, contacted Anne Arundel County Police back in 2013 and said this guy, Mr. Ramos, with whom he was involved in a lawsuit at the time, is a dangerous person. And he even made the comment to the police that this guy is your next mass shooter. When law enforcement gets that kind of information, which essentially is, I guess, a hunch from a civilian and not even a mental health professional, what do you think they should do with it? How do you think that kind of information and that kind of hunch should be handled?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that one thing that we have to keep in mind, those of us that don't work in law enforcement, is that presumably they get lots of these calls about people that may be a danger. He was right in this case. But I wonder how many calls they get from people saying, hey, I think this guy's dangerous, hey, I think that guy's dangerous. And there's only so many they can follow up on. So I can't fault them, I guess. However, from what I understand, having read about this case, might have been multiple people reporting that, that he was a danger. So I don't know what follow-up they did do, if any, but I guess that remains to unfold as the story opens up.
Dr. Paul Nestat from the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Nestat, thank you so much and appreciate it.
Thanks.
We turn now to Jamie Costello. He is an anchor at WMAR2 News. In the WMAR newsroom in 2014, on the 13th of May, their newsroom was attacked as well, not in the same way as the attack that occurred at the Capital Gazette. But Jamie Costello, welcome to the show. You guys have been through this, and I'm sure that your reporting on this yesterday must have had an eerily familiar feeling.
Well, we can't even be in the same ballpark as what happened with the Gazette yesterday. But we didn't know it at the first. I mean, it was a landscaping truck that rammed. I mean, who would have thought that? Ramming the front of the building until he got inside, and we didn't know what he had when he got inside. So I remember everybody just fleeing and running for cover. And I remember we were ramming out into the back, and we were in a gated area. So if he did have a weapon, it would have been a different story. But I just heard the president just now in a White House ceremony there talking about the economy, did get up and address what happened with the Gazette shooting yesterday.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. What did he have to say? I haven't heard that reporting yet.
Let me roll it back. He just said that the old thoughts and prayers, and we're not going to let violence, you know, rule this country and all that kind of stuff. So, but at least he addressed it. At least he addressed it, and he did mention the word journalism and journalist in it. So that's what a lot of people in the business were waiting to hear.
As you mentioned, back in 2014, a 28-year-old guy from Parkville got a stolen landscape truck and drove it through the front doors of the building. Your building is located a couple of blocks above Northern Parkway on York Road in North Baltimore. Smashed
right
through the building, gets in there, left some literature and some signs and stuff, and then luckily the event ended without anybody being hurt. They apprehended the suspect, and he's been in a mental health facility for the last few years, as I understand it. What changes happened after that event? How did the physical, how did the architecture of the building change, and did any procedures, policies, planning go into effect that hadn't been in effect prior to that? What changed at WMAR?
Well, what changed is, besides the planters out front, a new facade was put in out front. You have to pass through more doors to get inside. You have to have a reason to get inside. You have to have an appointment. Nobody gets in without anything like that. And they beefed it up. And then we had a couple weeks after, Baltimore County came in and ran a simulated course on what we should do, what we have to look out for, and all that kind of stuff. So we did have some training immediately after. And we did have some training beforehand, too. But you can't prepare for, you can prepare on what to do, where to run, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, this guy just rammed in, and he took out the elevator as well. I mean, it was a mess, but everything, and now you have to have passes even to go to the bathroom. You have to have a pass to, boom, hit the door so the door can open on you.
Your reporting that afternoon, this event happened before noon back in May of 2014, and your reporting when you were standing outside in front of the station, you were live and you were talking to the people who had been in the building who had been evacuated. It was extraordinary. But your conversations with the people who were directly affected by this, startling and frightening event, perhaps gives you some insight into how the folks at the Capital Gazette, the survivors, are feeling today and how they will feel 2 months from now and a year from now. God bless them. They put out a paper today. It's just incredible. But what can the folks at the Capital Gazette expect to feel as they move forward and process this incredible event?
Tom, that is the question I don't even have an answer for. Listening to Phil Davis yesterday, listening to Celine talk about, what was going on, to hear that the intern, Anthony Messinger, I was just on a boat with him. We were doing a story on paddle boating in Annapolis. There was a group of breast cancer survivors who are on their way to Florence this week to participate in a world. And he's an intern with the Gazette, and he was sitting right behind me on that boat. And this morning I saw him on national television talking about hiding under his desk to survive. And they ask him, are you going to go back tomorrow? And he says, I don't know. I mean, it's just up to that individual on whether they, I don't know how you can go back into that building, Tom. Yeah. I don't know how you can go back into that building.
Yeah, and as you say, there is a stark difference between what happened at WMAR 4 years ago and what happened yesterday in Annapolis, because there were no injuries, there were no deaths at WMAR, and there were five colleagues of these folks in that newsroom who were gunned down in cold blood in front of their eyes yesterday. So it's a totally different thing. When it comes to the President of the United States, who we've been talking a little bit about today, were the president to say all of a sudden, gee whiz, I've been wrong, the media is not the enemy of the people, the news is not fake in most instances, I apologize. Do you think anybody would take him seriously, given that we've got 3 years of the exact opposite message?
You ask a lot of great questions. I've had a great debate with a lot of my friends who are saying that you people in the media, you're jumping the gun, saying that this guy came in to attack the media. The only thing in the media, and those who are journalists, we have to look at everything. And we have to look and see whether the rhetoric from the White House played any kind of role in this man's thinking yesterday. And I know the lawsuit was way back when, and I know all that, but it's part of the business. It's like a carpenter. When a carpenter goes into a building, he'll look at the corners and he'll look at the wall and look at the floor. You know, they just don't look at one place. So that's what we're doing. That's our job. And fortunately, people can see what we're doing to come up with the complete story. And we have to really take a look and see whether the fake news, the enemy of the people, whether this played any kind of thought in this guy's process yesterday. And it's just because it's the nature of journalism that we have to find out everything, everything.
And with the deluge of information that we're given and that, you know, seeps out in social media and stuff, it can be very difficult for all of us to discern what's real, what's not real, what's fake, what's true.
Sure.
You know, Lord knows it could be coming from some Russian bot, or it could be coming from a very credible source. The discernment that this now requires is really amped up considerably from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, without doubt. Yeah.
But the Gazette, they weren't controversial. They covered Little League scores and ribbon cuttings and great events for the kids. They were a local newspaper.
Yeah.
That's all.
And they were of their community, as are you, sir. Jamie Costello, you've been with WMAR for 30-plus years, and I appreciate your time today. Appreciate your reporting on this, and we look forward to more of it as this story unfolds.
This is a great program, and I'm listening intently, and you're asking great, great questions to everybody. I appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Jamie Costello from WMAR 2 News. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We can't take your calls today. If you'd like to drop us an email or a tweet, you're welcome to do that. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people. Because they have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
President Trump speaking in February of last year to the CPAC convention in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. If you've just joined us, we've been listening to a number of different perspectives about the murders of four journalists and a sales representative at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis yesterday afternoon. My next guest is Joel Simon. He's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You track around the world deaths, imprisonments, missing journalists. How does the United States overall compare to other places around the globe when it comes to the dangers of the endeavor of journalism?
Well, let's talk about before today, or before yesterday, rather. I mean, the United States is obviously has the First Amendment. It obviously is a place where journalists in general work with great freedom and latitude, but we're not immune from violence. We don't live in some free expression paradise. In fact, there was a video journalist in Chicago named Zachary Stoner who was murdered in late May. We don't know precisely why. It could have been in reprisal for some reporting that he did. He was kind of a video blogger, covered the music scene there. And over over the course of the last 15 years that we've been tracking a journalist killed, there have been seven journalists killed in the United States. There's a history of violence against immigrant journalists. So the U.S. has challenges in this regard. I think it would be folly to suggest otherwise. But it is important to put what happened yesterday in perspective. Four journalists killed, a media worker. This is the most violent, the deadliest day that we've ever recorded in the United States for the media. This is an unprecedented action. And just to put it in a global context, and I'm not making a comparison, these are just the facts. Right now, the U.S. is the third most deadly country in 2018. Behind Afghanistan, where 10 journalists have been killed, and Syria, where 5 have been killed.
People have made a point to say this particular shooter's grudge was against this particular newspaper, stemming perhaps from a lawsuit that he lost, a defamation lawsuit. Mm-hmm. At least that's the allegation by the prosecutor. We'll see how that plays out as the court's process continues. Does it somehow make it any better or less worrisome that this is not a sort of vigilante, perhaps, who's upset about the media writ large?
Well, I think it's way too early to understand precisely what this individual's motivations are. You know, we just have a kind of bare skeleton in terms of the facts. But I want to make a slightly different point, which is related, which is that around the world and in this country as well, what we've seen is that it's actually local journalists, not national journalists, but local journalists covering their own communities who are most vulnerable. And we don't know precisely why this is, but we have some theories. One is that when you write about people in your own community, they know you. You interact directly with them. And so there's a kind of intimacy in the relationship that may not exist in a national level. The second is that the information is disseminated to people that this person may know. So their friends and their neighbors, and it may change the way that they are perceived in their community. So we don't know what precisely this individual's motivations are. It seems that it was a result of the coverage that the newspaper took on and an unsuccessful lawsuit. He threatened the newspaper. But it does conform to something that we've seen not just in the U.S. but around the world, which is that local journalists covering their own communities are much more vulnerable than people realize.
What's the antidote to this? We have about a minute left here. What can be done in terms of public policy? What can journalists themselves do? And what should we expect from our political leaders to fix this?
Well, let me answer that last question first. I think this is the moment when, you know, journalists can only do their work if they have the support of the community, the support of law enforcement, and the support of political leaders. And this is a time when political leaders, I think unquestionably at the national level, need to say very distinctly and very clearly that journalists play a vital role in our country's politics and communities across this country, that we need to honor that work and we need to reaffirm the values that they represent, values of free speech and tolerance, and we really need to recognize the vital role that journalism plays in our society, because clearly questions are being raised about that right now.
Joel Simon is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, thank you for your time and for your work. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's it for us today. Coming up on Midday Monday, an interview with Peter Franchot. He's the Comptroller of Maryland, who's running for re-election. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for lunch. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. They're available at the Waverly and the JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Reporters and editors and designers and others at the Capital Gazette published their newspaper today. Their email blast arrived in my inbox at 12:48 this morning. They covered their own terrifying experiences and the deaths of their friends and colleagues. Gerald Fishman, age 61. Rob Hyacin, age 59. John McNamara, age 56, Rebecca Smith, age 34, and Wendy Winters. She was 65 years old. A vigil to remember the victims will be held tonight at the Annapolis City Dock. It starts at 8 o'clock. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.